Hi, everybody. Jason Klom here. We're going to get into this episode very shortly, but I wanted to give you a little bit of background. My uncle-in-law, Dick Smith, is also known as John Rivers. He has been on the radio in San Francisco for a long time, a long career in radio, and he recently retired. And I just coincidentally planned a trip up there, basically landing the night that he ended up retiring. So his career was on his mind, and I decided I'd interview him and ask him about his history with comedy albums and his love of comedy. And what we happened upon was something he'd mentioned before, which is called Love of Strife. What you'll see in the picture of us is it's a 45, and that 45 is a promo 45 that was sent around to radio stations in the 70s. That had these very weird little interstitial sketches that were meant to be sold to radio stations. He'll explain all this, but I want to give you a heads up what this is about. It's an unusual thing. This is, while not one of a kind, a very rare thing, admittedly very silly. It's something that he wrote with friends and recorded with friends over a period, and it's a lot of fun. I only put a couple clips in here. I did my usual 1 minute, but I only put a couple clips in this because it's the same album, and it's the same joke, basically, here and there, same type of joke anyway. And so that's a ton of fun. Dick was really gracious to sit down with me and interview with me for an hour, and I really enjoyed it. I think you'll like this episode. Also, I wanted to give everybody a heads up in case you haven't seen it. We are on Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl. And for the last, since the beginning of the year, I've been doing a comedy album a day and hashtagging it Comedy Album a Day on Instagram and Twitter. And I'm listening to a comedy album a day for all of 2017 because I need to burn through my comedy albums. And I've done 11 so far, obviously. And the full videos are going up on YouTube. So youtube.com/comedyonvinyl. We might do something else with them. I might compile them, put them up somewhere else. I know that some of our videos are going to be, some new videos of ours are going to be going up on Stand Up Records Roku channel. So we'll see. Maybe something like that will happen with these. I don't know. But yeah, just follow us on all those different channels and just keep watching. I just talk about an album, usually that I haven't heard before. I'm trying to make it all stuff I haven't heard before. So yeah. Please give that a shot. And without further ado, here is the next episode of Comedy on Vinyl with Dick Smith, a.k.a. John Rivers. I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everybody. It's Jason Klom. I'm here in beautiful San Rafael, California, with my uncle-in-law, Dick Smith. Thank you for being here.
I can't tell you how pleased I am to be in my own house.
I know. I do this every time, and I forget, and I'm a moron, Dick. This is what happens. I'm going to drink some water now.
But you're good at it.
Uh-huh. Okay, so this is just perfect timing. You just retired.
I did.
After how many years in radio?
50.
50 years in radio.
Well, I lie. I entered my 50th year, which when you do the math means 49 years plus a few months.
It's fine. We can say 50.
It works.
I think that works out. So if I was to ask you, this is more of a let's just talk about whatever the hell you want to talk about, but are there any comedy albums that you grew up listening to that you absolutely love and still
Shelley
have good memories
Berman,
of?
Anything by Shelley Berman, Bob Newhart. I grew up in a Midwestern town of about, at that point, 90,000 people. It's down to about 50,000 these days.
Uh-huh.
GM, thank you. And had a large Victorian house built in the 1880s by some lumber baron. So we had a front living room and a back living room, as often they did. It was a front parlor and the back parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the front living room, which we really didn't use, we had a bumper pool table and one of those old combination TV radio phonograph players.
That's awesome.
And we discovered comedy when I was probably in junior high.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to be the point that the pool table was the draw. Kids would all of a sudden get up half an hour before their parents were ready to get them out of bed for school. Because if they swung by my house on the way to school, we could play pool for half an hour or so.
Uh-huh.
And then we would listen to comedy albums at the same time. And we discovered Shelley Berman was hot in those days. Bob Newhart, his timing was impeccable. And it got to the point that we memorized those comedy bits. And we didn't really move into any of the more, I think probably Shelley Berman was the most adult that we got into.
Mm-hmm.
There were rumors of Rusty Warren, who I know you've interviewed,
mm-hmm.
but they were only rumors.
Yeah.
We'd nudge one another and say, you know what she talks about? Yeah. And everybody go, oh, yeah. And nobody really knew. Nobody had a clue. We were 12.
Right. Oh, well, I love that you were 12 and you were into Shelley Berman.
He just, the bit where he was calling the department store where somebody was hanging by their fingertips and he kept getting put on hold. We cried when we heard that. And Bob Newhart with his Sir Walter Raleigh tobacco thing.
Oh, God, I love that one so much.
Yeah. I have to, you know, and God, I wish I had still had those albums.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think we literally wore them out.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I don't doubt it. So those were your parents' albums. Well, likely your mother's albums, right?
Actually, I think they were my older sister's.
Your older sister? Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
My parents' taste ran to Jack Parr in those days.
Okay.
And then Johnny Carson.
Sure.
But Bob Newhart, and particularly Shelley Berman, a little too cutting edge for them.
Okay.
In the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do they have Jack Parr's album? Because he did release one album, at least.
I don't think they did.
I have it somewhere. You can only find this album with, on the back, an advertisement for some kind of toothpaste or hair cream or some shit.
Panna, Brill Cream.
Yeah, something like that.
A little dabble, do you?
But they're all torn off every time you try and find one. That's funny to me, though, that it's all came down from Sue.
It did. She was 5 years older, so when I was 12, she would have been 17,
mm-hmm.
senior year in high school.
Sure.
And very cosmopolitan,
mm-hmm.
at least for Michigan.
Yeah.
And I benefited from that.
Yeah. So we're going to skip forward a few years. How did you get into radio?
The weird thing is, and I only realized this probably within the last year or two, that probably the reason I went into radio, stop and think about radio.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks, oh, you have this great interaction with people.
Mm-hmm.
You walk into a booth, you close the door, you're by yourself for anywhere from 4 to 8 hours, depending on what company you work for.
Right.
And you talk into the ether by yourself. You're not necessarily really a people person.
Right.
But I think that probably my first inclination toward radio came the night my father died.
Mm-hmm.
He had a stroke, cerebral hemorrhage. You know, in those days, they really didn't, you know, he died.
Yeah.
And I woke up to the medics carrying him out of the house to go to the hospital. And I was the only one in the house awake at that point. My mm-hmm. mother went with him, obviously. My little brother slept through the whole thing. My sister was in Holland as an exchange student. And so I'm there by myself, and I turned the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
And you try and think, you know, should I pray? What should I? And the next thing I know, I'm singing along with the songs mm-hmm. and listening to the disc jockey. And in later years, and I mean literally just recently, I realized that that was somebody who kept me company at a tough time.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably what I wanted to do. I found through my career that, particularly when I was single before I had a child, that when somebody was needed to work on Thanksgiving or Christmas, I would do it because I remembered those were times mm-hmm. that you might need somebody.
Right. Yeah.
Had no clue that's why I did it, but I really think that's probably why I got into it. The other thing was that I had tried theater.
Mm-hmm.
That was okay. You know, there's a lot of us. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, listen, as you talk to the agent, I killed him in our town at high school. Will you represent me?
Hit the road, kid.
Yeah.
And nobody ever told me you couldn't.
Yeah.
So it was, and where I lived, it was either that or the auto factory. And I tried the auto factory.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Third shift. You haven't lived till you've had a beer and a burger at 6:30 in the morning because you just finished working 8 hours.
Jesus.
And by the sixth week, I'd figured out half a dozen ways to kill my foreman and not get caught. And I realized that this is probably not a good career path.
Probably not.
And about that time, I'd done a little bit of radio. And about that time, the morning guy at a local small wattage AM station walked off the air.
Yeah.
And the program director called me and said, I need somebody. Can you fill in until I find somebody? And I said, well, you know, I'm working in the auto factory. And I'm making pretty good money, and I don't get off shift until 6:30. He said, I'll have the overnight guy stay an extra half hour. Get here as quick as you can. So for a week or two, literally, I was working third shift in the auto factory and walking in my auto factory outfit with steel-tipped shoes and doing mornings. And I thought, this is so much more fun.
Yeah.
And it smells better.
I can only imagine.
And if you've ever been in a radio station in the late 60s, early 70s, when smoking was still...
Oh, yeah, huh?
That's saying a lot that it smelled better than the studio. You know, so so I gave my notice at the auto factory and was told I was stupid because there was a great career in at GM.
Mm-hmm.
10 of the 11 factories are now closed in my hometown, Jesus. So I think I made the right decision.
Do you remember the name of the DJ that you were listening to the night your dad passed?
No.
No.
That would have been 1960.
Okay.
And actually, I listened to radio a lot. I won a 45 when I was 8 years old. I called and answered some question. When I was 6 years old, and I hadn't thought about this in a long time, when I was 6 years old, I went to a birthday party for a kid that I went to school with, Bob Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often wondered whatever happened to Bob. And it was an afternoon birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
Boys full of sugar running around being crazy. And his father came in and wished him happy birthday and left for work at like 5 in the afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And as he left, he said, what do you want me to play for you? And I thought, that's a strange thing.
Mm-hmm.
6:30, we turn on the radio, and there's Bob's father on the radio playing a birthday song for his son. I thought, that is so cool.
That's amazing.
So I think that's a lot of things.
Yeah.
It's stuck there in my mind because all of a sudden, at the age of 6, a disc jockey was not somebody on a pedestal. Mm. Disc jockey was some kid's father.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why not do it?
Sure. That's awesome. Do you... I've completely forgotten my question, Dick. This is typical of the show. This happens every time. We're going to
can't tell you the number of times I did that on the air.
Sure. So we got 10:18. That's Jason's first mistake on the podcast. That's okay. It's not going to continue to happen. I've got... Oh, no, that was... This is a very obvious question. If we skip back just a little bit, like what kind of comedy, if any, were you only listening to radio, music radio, or was there like comedy shows and stuff that you were... You're just the right age where the tail end of the serials might have been on, right?
I'm old enough that I remember hearing The Lone Ranger on radio.
Okay, yeah.
And the cool thing is that later on in my career as a side thing in between radio gigs, because you get let go frequently, I worked as a computer consultant.
Mm-hmm.
I ran my own little small business, and I found that most of my clients were lawyers who had no clue what they wanted for a computer in their house. This is an era when they were still realizing, oh, I guess I need a computer at home.
Uh-huh.
And they would one by one, you know, put me in touch with somebody else, and they'd say, I was going to get this. Well, that's a gamer's dream, but all you want to do is word processing, right? So I'd help him set up. And one of the lawyers that I wound up working with was a fellow by the name of Tom McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was a delightful gentleman, lived in the East Bay here in the San Francisco area, and was a professor at the University of San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out a world-renowned expert, possibly the expert, on proprietary... and I'm forgetting the term, it would be proprietary identity. McDonald's, Coca-Cola.
Okay.
They had him on retainer.
Oh, wow.
And may still, I'm not sure.
Holy crap.
And he helped them make sure that they maintained
their rights to the shape of the Coca-Cola bottle.
Oh, wow.
To the golden arches and everything that goes with McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that he was from Detroit,
mm-hmm.
south of where I grew up. And it turns out that his father was the Lone Ranger,
oh.
one of them, on WXYZ in the broadcasts in the early days of the Lone Ranger on radio.
Wow.
I mean, what are the odds of that?
That's mind-blowing.
And one of the cool things, as we talked, I said, well, you must have recordings of your father. He said, no, I have never heard him.
What?
And at that point, I had just hooked him up on the internet, and I said, hang on. And I went in and found him a couple of the programs of his father,
mm-hmm.
and he was blown away that was possible.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Holy shit. You know, I didn't realize, honestly, until starting to research for the Comedy on Vinyl book that I'm slowly but surely trudging away at writing.
And we're waiting to read it.
Oh, I know. It'll take a while.
Okay.
We'll get there. But one of the things I'm writing is the history of sketch comedy, and did not realize that the precursor to Fibber McGee and Molly, which the name of which I cannot... Oh, I think it's called The Smiths, if I'm not mistaken.
It may have been. Yeah, there was one that came on before that.
And it's from Detroit.
And it led to... Yes, Detroit was a central point for a lot of things out of there.
Yeah.
There was the Lone Ranger. Was the Green Hornet also,
really?
I think, initially out of Detroit?
That's awesome.
There was a lot of things that came out of there. And quite frankly, it was driven not necessarily by creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It was driven by ad agencies,
okay,
creating something for a client.
Sure, sure.
You know, they needed something that would fit for their identity, grab an audience, and their commercials would stand out.
Yeah. Did that work on you? Do you think? Where as a kid, like, were there like any products that were like, I hear it on the radio all the time, so it's part of my life?
Probably at an early age, cereals.
Sure.
Yeah. I was at an age where TV was started breaking in. When I was
mm-hmm.
small town, no TV station initially.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It wasn't until I was probably 8 that TV came to my hometown.
Okay.
Which I know is a little hard to believe when you have 500 stations and nothing to watch. Thank you, Bruce. I don't think I was ever impacted that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They didn't grab me.
But you did really, it sounds like you really liked the Lone Ranger.
That just sticks in my mind.
Okay, that's what sticks in your mind.
Because about
okay.
the time I discovered it, it wasn't long after that it went off the radio.
Okay.
But it came on TV.
Sure, sure, sure. That's true. That's a good point. So how many... can you name every station you've worked at?
Oh, sure.
And
I'm not sure they want me to.
How many different names have you used?
We've this is one of those... them. First station was WSAM
mm-hmm.
in my hometown. And everybody had to be named Sammy. and generally what they would do is they would take your first name and make it your new last name. So my first name was Richard, so I became Sammy Richards.
Okay.
There was Sammy Williams. Guess what his first name was? And then the joke was, south of us there was a town that had a country western station, and it was the home of the Jones Boys, and everybody was named Jones,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Pick a Jones, they had it. And the joke was the two stations were going to merge and it was going to be 24 hours of Sam Jones. So that was my first name. Second job that I had was the only time I used my real name.
Okay.
And they insisted on it. And,
really?
And, it just... The problem is that in that era, radio stations had jingles with the jock's name.
Okay.
Sammy Richards. Dick Smith didn't work.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain number of syllables.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was only there about a year and a half or so. And then I became Mark Richards.
Mm-hmm.
Then I became Jim Maxwell.
That's a good
one. That was a variation on the Sammy Richards theme because the station was WMAX.
Okay.
So I became Jim Maxwell. Then I went to Buffalo, and I went to work for a gentleman by the name of Gordon McClendon, who was known as the Old Scotsman, and he really was a cheap son of a gun. But he had stations in Buffalo and Dallas and Detroit and I think L.A. And in those days, every station had its own jingle package. Well, uh-huh. He bought one jingle package for all the stations. The only variation on those packages was the call letters. Everybody had the same weather jingle, the same news jingle, the same sports jingle.
Okay.
And the same
disc jockey names. There would be perhaps a package of 10 or 12 names.
Uh-huh.
And when you came to work for him, unless you were well-known mm-hmm. in that market with your own name, you had to pick one of the unused names. And I was given three choices. There was Eric Chase,
mm-hmm.
Brother John Rivers,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember what the third one was. And I chose Brother John Rivers,
mm-hmm.
who really had made his name in Dallas. And I met him some years later. So I became Brother John Rivers. And that's pretty much what I used ever since. I used that in Florida. I used it in Chicago, Seattle. In Memphis, I became Mississippi John Rivers.
Awesome.
The Mississippi Rivers. I used it here in the Bay Area. I went from one station to another here in San Francisco, and they didn't want me using John Rivers because I used it on the other station, their
okay.
competitor.
Okay.
So I went back to Mark Richards.
Okay.
But that's pretty much the limit.
It's so funny. I have to imagine you. Do you get recognized by your voice, or do people, or is it so different? Because I don't know that I've heard
every
your
once
radio
in a
voice.
While. Well. You know, it's interesting. You're more recognized by your voice in a small town
yeah.
than you are in a metropolis like you know,
sure.
the Bay Area.
Sure.
Occasionally, though, you'll run into somebody who goes, "You sound familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Have I met you before?"
Mm-hmm.
No, I'll say.
No interest in engaging in
Not
that.
Really.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, there's a reason I go into a studio, close mm-hmm. the door, and talk into a microphone.
And nobody sees you. Understandable. all right. So when you're DJing at mm-hmm. any, if I'm not mistaken, it was music the whole time. Or did you ever work for a station where you got to play comedy or comedy music?
There was a period here in San Francisco at KFOG, KFOG, that they tried an experiment,
mm-hmm.
and. On one hand, it was interesting. On the other hand, it really didn't work too well. Where they made the morning they hired a comedian as the morning person.
Okay.
And as a result, we became one of the key stops in the Bay Area for any comedy act moving through. They would roll in, and there's nothing more interesting, let us say, than a comedian who has just done two shows the night before, the last one ending somewhere around 12:30, 1 a.m.,
uh-huh.
rolling into a radio station at 6 in the morning to try and be funny.
Yeah.
Some of them could do it. Some of them had no clue. There was one consistent request from every one of them, coffee.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an era where we had some really interesting people. It was 83, mm-hmm. 84. I just saw a picture the other day. Local guy does stand-up and is just a stand-up guy. I mean, he is so active in the community. Michael Pritchard.
Mm-hmm.
Does voices for a number of cartoon TV series
mm-hmm.
out of L.A. Good, good person. Posted on his Facebook website. He posted a picture from the 83 San Francisco Comedy Competition.
Hmm.
And it's a very, as you look at it, the picture includes a very, very young Jerry Seinfeld.
That's awesome. 83.
Child-looking Dana Carvey. Kevin Pollak is in there. Michael Pritchard is in there. And a very hairy, young Robin Williams. I mean, the comedy competition here in the Bay Area was just incredible at that. And all these people would pass through.
Sure.
We had Kevin Pollak on a couple of times. And, you mm-hmm. know, it's amazing that he's become the actor he has. He's good.
Yeah.
You know, but he was pretty – and he was one of those who was really together at that early morning hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could tell who'd been out partying, and you can tell who were focused.
Yeah.
He was focused.
That's good. That's a lot of. But eventually they axed this.
It
sort of
it just
format.
Didn't work because our audience was very interested in the music.
Mm-hmm.
They were the comedy audience for these folks as they came through the area, but the problem that we had was that the host didn't understand that. you riff for 5 to 10 minutes and then you get back to the music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't riff 20 to 30 minutes. And in his defense, I know how comedians work. I've been there enough to see that you get rolling, you don't want to stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the problem is that you're entertaining one another.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know how it's going off with the audience because they're not there.
Yeah.
They're in their car going, give me some music, click. Why am I stuck in traffic, click.
Did you, okay, so if you didn't have a whole lot of, it was all music, which is, you know, respectable. It's good. It's fine. But since we're talking about comedy, I'm going to try and veer us towards what kind of comedy you listened to after you were 12 years old and listening to Shelley Berman. Where'd it go from there?
I fell in love with comedic writing.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much the stand-up. I mean, Bob Saget
mm-hmm.
cracked me up. I'm not talking about the Bob Saget of Full House.
Right.
I'm talking about the Bob Saget that you go and you go, come on, cats, let's go see Bob because he's on Full House and you're going to love him. And suddenly you find yourself covering your ears going, oh, my God, what is he? That's not really Bob Saget. Yeah, that's pretty friggin' funny.
Were you going to see a lot of stand-up live?
No, because I was getting up at 4:30 in the morning to go to work.
Yeah. So where were you getting a taste of this?
As they passed through, I would occasionally go if it was a weekend situation where I could get in.
Mm-hmm.
And the best part of it was I got in for free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I'd make sure I did the 2-drink minimum, but
sure. That's fun.
Yeah.
Oh.
But I found that I was getting more into sketch comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday Night Live, obviously, a huge part because it hit as I was at the right age.
Yeah.
We had Saturday Night Live. I had trouble with a lot of the more coarse stand-up.
Mm-hmm. You know,
maybe that's my Midwest puritanical. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I have no problem with blue language, but the problem I have with is something that is just has a nasty edge to it.
Yeah.
You know,
like a Sam Kinison?
Has no kindness in it.
We think Sam Kinison? That's the first thing that pops into my head.
You know, Sam is a sweet man.
Uh-huh.
Because Sam would come through.
Uh-huh.
And we would have to take him aside and say, okay, you need to tone it down. And he would.
Yeah.
You know. And off the air, with the mic off,
mm-hmm.
I could not think of a better person to hang with.
So interesting.
But he was very good in going into that act.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a lot of them like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, if you're okay with it, let's talk about something I got to see for the first time today.
Yeah. What did you get to see?
Yeah, the Year 45 from 1972. I mean, we could not do this okay. and not talk about it.
I was in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and married my first wife, good friend of ours, a guy who actually got me my first announcing gig
mm-hmm.
When I was in junior college working at the PBS station.
Uh-huh.
He was the booth announcer, and he was going on to Michigan State, and they needed a replacement. He recommended me, and I got the gig.
All right.
So, you know, I guess it's his fault that I did what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But we had started a company. We decided we were going to do a comedy series. And we were quite frankly looking something we wanted to do beyond that, but we were looking for something that would sell quickly, that would be easy to produce, inexpensive to produce. And we came up with a short 30 to 45 second comedy episode that would be sold to radio stations as a 13-week series,
mm-hmm.
one a day. It allowed them to, you had an open for each program. You allowed them to sell probably a 30-second commercial,
mm-hmm.
and then the 30 to 45-second program content, and then a close. And then we would do promos for, you know, the sponsor, brought to you by, that would run through the day. So the sponsor got all kinds of coverage. They were able to sell a package to an advertiser, and we would have money to go on and build something else, maybe a little more. And basically, it was just a series of horrid puns. I had not heard it literally. I have the 8-track in my attic. It's probably not error, you know, not playable now, but I heard it for the first time in 40 years, just within the last year.
You'll remember the last time we left John and Marcia. They were in Tell Me, Wyoming, where John was complaining about the heat. Let's listen.
Boy, is it ever hot. Marcia, would you crack a window?
All right, John.
Marcia!
John?
Be with us again next time when John and Marcia go to an all-night coffee shop and get mugged. You'll remember the last time we left John and Marcia. They were in 5 and Tennessee, where John had just run into an old friend. Let's listen.
Why, Marcia, it's my old friend, Fred!
Fred?
Fred! Fred?
Fred! Anybody seen my teeth?
Be with us again next time when Marcia swallows her pride and chokes to death.
One of the guys who did a voice, I reconnected with him, and he had it digitally. And you heard it earlier today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Give me your opinion. And here's where we turn the table. Jay, tell me, when you heard it, how wrenched did your stomach become?
Here's the thing. I have been writing bad puns my whole life, and I love a good bad pun. I do understand why you cringe, because it's very persistent.
It's persistent.
To write that many bad puns is simultaneously maybe frustrating, but also like impressive, because some of them are such reaches. It's such a long reach I'm like, wow, they worked real hard to get to that dumb joke, and you got to respect that.
Oh, and you know,
so I enjoyed it on that level.
We were, the group of us were naive,
mm-hmm.
or if you want, stupid enough that we figured, why not?
Yeah.
And we pooled our money. We bought studio time. We spent 2 or 3 weeks in a major recording studio, at least for the town we were in.
Mm-hmm.
We had original theme music recorded for it,
mm-hmm.
with the organ. It was a takeoff on John and Marcia, which Stan Freberg, his famous record, John.
Marcia.
And so our leads were John and Marcia, and it was basically a 2, maybe 3 punch story.
Mm-hmm.
The announcer would come on, you'll remember the last time we left John and Marcia. They were in 5 and Tennessee. Joke one.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear John say, Marcia! What was the line? I'm blanking on it. Marcia, hit the lights, will you? And then you hear a hammer smashing lamps.
Mm-hmm.
And the punch, the closeout was always, Marcia!
John,
it was total idiocy.
Mm-hmm.
The amazing thing is, we had stations buy it.
So good.
And we were contacted by an Australian group of stations that wanted an Australian version of it. And we told them, great, but listeners don't understand 5 in Tennessee.
Yeah.
So we had to recut it, the opens anyway, with Australian cities. They sent us a list of cities. We worked out some jokes. Had to do 65 of them.
Jeez.
Because there are 65 episodes.
Yeah.
13 weeks, 5 days a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And they bought it. Armed Forces Radio bought it. And we still went bankrupt.
But you did cut like a demo 45.
We cut a demo 45. And those were the days where you didn't have to go to Czechoslovakia to have a record done.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a friend who's done a Kickstarter I asked her where she was having the records pressed, expecting to hear, Sacramento or mm-hmm. San Jose. It's Czechoslovakia. It's the only plant apparently that presses vinyl.
That's great.
But in those days, we're in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and our decision was, do we go to Detroit and have it pressed there, or mm-hmm. have it pressed locally in Grand Rapids? There was a pressing plant there.
That's so good, yeah.
So we had 45s cut. We had die cut, jackets cut. The fellow who did the voiceover for the demo was John Leader, who went on to some renown as the editor of our Radio and Records magazine,
mm-hmm.
and made a nice living in L.A. doing voiceovers for movie trailers.
It's so funny.
Nice man. Yeah. Just a great man. Did it for free.
That's great.
John, if you're listening, I'm still not going to pay you.
Now, it's funny because earlier you said, well, we decided we were going to do this. Whose idea was it to do this? This just seems...
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
You know, this was one of those things that was probably cooked up late at night. The people, the voices involved, I was the announcer, 5 in Tennessee. Mike McCarthy, I worked with a couple of different stations and is now retired, living just north of Portland, was John. My ex-wife, who lives in British Columbia now,
mm-hmm.
and is a Canadian citizen, not a bad choice,
mm-hmm.
was Marcia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we may have had one or two other people if we needed a standout voice step in. But other than that, and then the fellow that got me into, Gary Rivard, who got me into announcing, was the president of our company.
Yeah.
I got to be the vice president. My wife, Lau, was, you know, I couldn't tell you what her title was, but I know she had a title, and she really was the motivating factor. But somewhere, at some point, probably late at night over wine, beer, and or controlled substances, mm-hmm. the idea came forth, and we thought it was great, so we did it.
Do you know how much it cost you?
I couldn't tell you.
No?
You know, it was probably not a lot in today's money.
Sure.
But when you're not making very much, like we were not making very much,
mm-hmm.
we really scrimped and saved.
It's a massive gamble. Is it based on your knowledge of understanding radio and radio economics, or was it just a whim? It can't be just a whim. There had to have been something else where you're like, I know what people want.
I blame Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney.
Hey, let's have a show. I've got a barn. We can do it there. You know?
Yeah, it's so upsettingly American, and it's something we all fall victim to if we're creative.
Well, it's like, why not? You know, does it kill anybody? No.
Sure.
Does it hurt anybody seriously? No. Will we starve if it doesn't work? Maybe. Well, let's do it.
And okay, so your plan, go through how you decide. Okay, so this demo was to go to program managers and directors at radio, right?
So we mailed out this 45. We had it printed up. First of all, we had to change the name of the company because initially we were called Ducks Unlimited. and we got this lovely cease and desist letter because apparently there's a natural resources, environmental protection, Save the Ducks group. And they do great work. We love you. But they didn't appreciate us using their name, so we changed it to Duck Productions, which worked out fine.
Sure.
And our plan was we have a limited amount of money. We get the records pressed. We get the die cut done. We mail it out to radio stations on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then based on the return from that, if you hit 800 radio stations and you get, we figured, 2% of them?
Yeah.
You know, that's one out of 50.
Yeah.
Says, okay, we'll buy it, and it was affordable, God knows. Then we're going to have enough money to roll out a mailing to the Midwest and maybe the Mountain Time Zones.
Yeah.
And based on that, then we hit the West Coast, and from there on, we see what we can do.
Yeah.
And so we did the initial mailing. It went out. We started to get returns, but not very many. We got probably 12 or 15 stations bought it.
Okay.
And then we discovered that most of the stations never got the mailing because we had bulk mailed rather than going first class. And there was a flood at the main distribution site in Pennsylvania, which wiped out a lot of our mailing. And when you go bulk, you've got no recourse with the postal department, you know, postal office.
Man.
And so we just pretty much lost it.
Yeah.
We, you know, about that time we got the inquiry from Australia. We did that. That was 12 stations. We got Armed Forces Radio. They don't pay much. And we decided to pack it in.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you, what was it like making it, though? Was it a lot of fun?
Oh, God, we had fun. We probably wasted more time in the studio. You know, if I was to go back and do it now, kids, don't try this at home. Mm-hmm. If I was going to go back and try it now, we would do so much more advanced prep.
Yeah.
We wound up a lot of time. Well, part of the problem was we had to record at night because we're all working day jobs.
Yeah.
And so we'd roll into the studio anywhere from 4 in the afternoon until 7 in the evening and work there until 10 or 11 at night and lay these things down. But we were basically, in retrospect, doing a lot of rehearsal there.
Okay, okay.
And killing studio time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And let's face it, studio time is not cheap, although in those days, compared to now, it certainly was.
Okay.
I think we were probably paying 50 or 70 bucks an hour.
Okay.
Which, you know,
yeah,
for an 8-track studio.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's fun.
So.
And you said earlier, like, because there's, I liked the, they're kind of rich in terms of, like, the sound effects. Whenever there are sound effects necessary, they're all really good. They all sound really nice. That,
thanks. You know, my mom did them.
Oh, wonderful.
We relied on the studio had, open license rights.
Mm-hmm.
For public domain type things. And if we couldn't find what we liked, then we would try and create it.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing we really did create was we walked in and they had a Hammond organ in there. Because, I mean, they did rock and roll. I'm trying to remember. This may be the studio where Al Green recorded Backup Train, which was his first hit.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, okay, let's do the... Because it was a soap opera type approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Love of Strife.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a fella come in that played the organ, and we had him, you know, lay down the tracks for the open and the close.
Those do sound great.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's good stuff. I mean, I mean, again, like you said, you have to prepare your expectations a little bit. I wouldn't say lower. You said lower earlier.
Oh, no.
I mean, here's the thing. We've explained. They're dumb puns. But you also listening to it, it's like clearly you know that they're dumb puns. The characters are commenting on how bad right. The puns are. It's fun.
We were going for a groan.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want a knee slapper, a side splitter.
Yeah.
We wanted a groan. God knows we got it.
I want to know how the armed forces rated. Like, I think probably out of all of them, if they played it enough, like, you probably got more audience from those. I bet people heard it and remember it. Again, maybe not fondly, but it doesn't matter. I bet
people listened to it and threw boots at the room. you have, I mean, I look back to that era because this was 72 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So we were still in Vietnam. So I mean, not only were these guys dealing with everything over there, they were having to deal with us.
Yeah.
There was no off time.
So, you know, actually, that was a question I was going to ask earlier. Were you in college, and that's how you got out of having to deal with all that crap?
Initially, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
College, I had not a really high number, but mm-hmm. I was in junior college, and then I was a radio television major, had a 4.0,
all right,
in radio TV, overall.
Mm-hmm.
I had a 1-1 because I tended not to go to the classes that weren't radio TV. It didn't interest me. I didn't go. I was running TV camera for the CBS television affiliate for the 6 and 11 news.
Wow. Okay.
I was working in the PBS station on campus and laying down voice tracks for that and going to school when I felt like it. So the grade point average eventually precluded me from avoidance of the draft.
Yeah.
And by the time they called me up, and they did call me up, or tried to, I was working in radio.
Yeah.
I was doing overnights at the AM station. And so I got this is something that only probably happens in that era in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
I got my notice to go to Detroit. I was going to have to show up at the center in my hometown, be bused to Detroit and check, you know, see if I passed the physical and was eligible. And I went to my local board and as in a small town, I knew, you know, my family knew a couple of people on the
board,
and said, look, here's the situation. You want me at the bus station at 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
I get off the air at 6.
Mm-hmm.
How about if I drive down and meet you guys down there?
Uh-huh.
And they went, okay.
All right.
Now, that's not going to happen today.
Sure, sure.
So I drove to Detroit, and I went through the physical, and they determined that I had been in an auto accident.
Mm-hmm.
And it had severed a nerve that comes out of the above the occipital bone. And it spreads like a tree on your skull. And that's how the skin on your skull mm-hmm. has feeling. And that had severed that. So I had,
wow.
basically, I was a numbskull on that side. And there, I swear to God, their reasoning was for giving me, you know, 4F or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Their reasoning was, you could be wounded
and
bleed to death and not know it. It's like, well, yeah, well, that's my biggest worry.
You're right. Oh, my God. That's
so
crazy.
They told me, you know, hit the road.
So at that point, you're so deep into radio. When did you first start actually doing, what was your first experience doing radio at all? Did you do any in high school? Was that
no.
a thing? Not even possible?
No. And the interesting thing is my high school, and I talked to a couple of the folks involved in this. My high school, which was not that big, you know, we thought it was, but
mm-hmm.
probably my graduating class was a couple of hundred, maybe 300 people.
Mm-hmm.
My class and the three following classes from that high school, there are a half a dozen of us that went into radio.
Mm-hmm.
And we all worked what are considered to be major markets. Toronto, Canada, Cleveland, Ohio, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, Seattle, Phoenix, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, you know, my brother went, your you know, father-in-law
mm-hmm.
went into radio and had a good career until he became a lawyer.
Yeah.
And that ruined everything. but it was really interesting. I think part of the reason that so many people came out of that high school, that was the era of junior achievement. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Mm-mm.
Junior achievement was a coordination of local businesses and high school students
mm-hmm.
where they would tutor, they would mentor the students and how business works. Mm-hmm. And the student's job was to figure out a business to create.
Okay.
I was given to a business that we wound up making reflector lights for driveways. It's not great. but one of them was sponsored by the local radio station.
Okay.
And so they were given a half an hour of radio time a week. And it was up to them to produce something in that half hour and deliver it. And two of the people that were in that did go into radio. I wanted to be in that one. I didn't. So I went in anyway.
Yeah.
And I really think that was part of it. It
huh.
kind of showed everybody, hey, you know, it's no big deal. You can do it.
Right, right. So you talked about earlier, though, that your friend got you the gig at PBS. Did you, at that point, were you well-known for having a natural speaking voice?
No.
I'm curious about that.
I had an attitude. basically, at that point, I was switching
mm-hmm.
on air. The beauty of that PBS station in the small college that I was at was that it was student run.
Mm-hmm.
It was student camera persons. There was a director that was a professor, you know, so he would be the director. But the tech director, the director would call the shots and call it, take it, fade it, whatever. It was a student doing the actual pushing and fading.
Okay.
We learned to run the audio.
Mm-hmm.
We learned to light the set. We learned to set up audio for the set. We went out and we filmed. We did everything.
That's awesome.
It was incredible. You know, we had no idea that it was unusual until years later.
Yeah.
We just took it for, you know, well, that's the way it works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I went from there to running camera for the CBS affiliate. We did all kinds of things. You know, mm-hmm. I was a play-by-play guy for basketball. I was awful. Awful. But then so was the team, so nobody watched. I think that's it was just one of those things that Gary, when he was ready to move on, we'd known each other, and he decided that, you know, of everybody else, he would trust me to do it more than anybody else.
Okay.
For whatever reason.
How long did it take you to cultivate your voice, though? Has this always been your speaking voice? It can't be. There's no way.
Somewhere I have a bunch of cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things that was on the radio, it must have been 68, 67, we convinced the college to let us do a rock and roll concert. It was an all-day event. It was in the gymnasium, big gym. We had a stage at one end and a stage at the other end. So a group is playing at one end while we're setting up the next group at the other.
Mm-hmm.
All day long, like 12 groups.
Mm-hmm.
And we booked groups out of Detroit. We had Bob Seger and the Bob Seger Sound System, which is the group that preceded Silver Bullet Band.
All right.
We had the Amboy Dukes when Ted Nugent was with them.
Wow.
We had a lot of local groups. Brownsville Station, we had the MC5.
Mm-hmm.
We had Iggy Pop.
Holy shit.
Iggy Pop, I'll tell you about that in a second.
Uh-huh.
And so we advertised.
Mm-hmm.
We had a $500 advertising budget.
Okay.
And we decided locally we didn't need to advertise because on campus the word would get around.
Sure.
Out to the area towns. But we wanted Detroit. We needed Detroit to come in to see these groups.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was twofold. One, record the commercial. And two, buy the radio time.
Mm-hmm.
So I recorded the commercial, and I sound horrendous. I found copies of it. And this Saturday. So no, I didn't always have that voice. But I went to Detroit to buy the time, and we decided to buy it on a WABX was the station, and it was something new. It was something called Progressive. And I went down and I met with the salesman who happened to be the program director and the morning guy.
Okay.
Not really the morning guy, because, well, I'll tell you about that in a second. He was one of the disc jockeys. And all I knew was I said, I want morning and afternoon drive, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. or 3 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And he leaned back and he said, well, that's a problem. You see, we're a little different. Oh, we don't go on the air until 10, 11 in the morning. We go off about 4 or 5. I said, what?
Oh,
well, our audience isn't necessarily there in the morning. They're mostly passed out. And probably what you want is 10 at night to 3 in the morning. And I was just so befuddled, I went, okay. And so that's what we bought. Uh-huh. And they ran the commercials, and we sent somebody out to on the freeway overpass to count cars.
Mm-hmm.
And there were cars full coming out of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
There would be 4, 5, 6 people in a car.
Wow.
So we did okay.
Wow.
Now, if you want to know how the concert went,
uh-huh.
Read Iggy Pop's biography.
Uh-huh.
Well, maybe it's the autobiography. I'm not sure which. In which he talks about the junior college where he jumped off the stage, as he often did.
Sure.
Into the crowd, grabbed a girl, threw her over his shoulder, and jumped back up on stage.
Uh-huh.
I think he was bloody by that time. He bloodied himself a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, the girl he chose in this situation was the dean's daughter.
No!
And that was the last, for my understanding, to this date, rock and roll concert that college has ever had.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. 68, you said?
68, maybe.
Holy crap. Yeah.
Thank you, Iggy.
Wow. That's amazing.
And the interesting thing is that the majority of the crowd, other than the people that came out of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
the majority of the crowd in this small, mostly farming, auto industry community,
mm-hmm.
stood there watching slack-jawed.
I bet.
What's he doing? I'm not sure. Is it art? No, it's Iggy.
It's scaring me. Yeah. It's probably art. Wow. So it's the impression you're giving me, which is not something I think that I anticipated, is that you got into radio in an era, or at the very least, through in a method that was that taught you to be a self-starter in a lot of ways.
Oh, you had to be.
That's crazy to me. The assumption is it's there for you. You go, you sit down, you make the connections, you read. But it sounds like you had to know so much of everything, and I didn't count on that.
Well, but you sort of learn it along the way.
Yeah.
Or if you don't know it, you look real positive and go, oh, yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
And then you read a lot.
Right.
I would get a job, and the first thing I would do is find out what kind of audio board they had.
Mm-hmm.
I would find pictures of that audio board, and I would play act on it.
Oh my God!
Okay, I'm gonna play a record. And this is the here's that knob, and this is my mic, and literally. So when I walked in, I felt familiar with that audio board.
That's crazy to me.
You know, but that was.
But that's perfect.
I'm told I'm anal.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I love that. So there's that. There's you're learning at a very young age how to do TV production.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
How old were you at that time?
I would have been 18.
Yeah, that's perfect time.
Yeah.
That is perfect time. Because I was lucky enough to do that kind of thing when I was 14.
There you go. So you beat me by 4.
But I was no good at it, right? I'll show you the shitty short film we did.
Oh, listen.
Oh, boy.
I wish I had what I did.
Yeah?
What was your film?
Well, luckily, it was not the thing that I chose to write. It was they picked the older kids.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's disavowing it.
Well, no, but my horrible voice is in it. My horrible pubescent nasally voice is in it.
Nobody likes their own voice, Jay. Let me tell you. Nobody likes their – to this day, I do not like my own voice. Don't.
You don't?
No.
Why? Nope. Why? That's the first thing I noticed when I met you at my wedding.
Because everybody has – a self-image, false as it may be.
Sure.
And part of that is an expectation of what you want something to be.
Mm-hmm.
My nose is too crooked. My ears are too large. My eyebrows sag. You know, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever you're not happy with, whatever you expect it to be, it's going to fall short.
Sure.
It just is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just so funny. So when I first met you, I think I told Jen, I'm like, is that his real voice all the time? Does he always sound like that? It blew my mind. But again, it's probably a voice that you're used to. It's just your natural voice now, but it can't have always.
Well, it's like somebody early on said to me, what you have to understand is that the vocal cords are a muscle.
Yeah.
And it's like anything else. You work it out, it gets stronger.
Yeah.
It modifies. It changes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you... If you're going to enunciate on stage, let's say.
Sure.
It is a bitch.
It is.
Initially.
Yeah.
But if you stick with it, it becomes secondary and you no longer think about it. It
sure.
just happens.
Yeah.
And I guess that happens that way too.
That's true. I will go back and say, if you guys go to YouTube and look for Boy with a Rat's Brain, that's the name of the short film we did.
Okay, Boy with a Rat's Brain.
I'll show it to you. My voice is in it. My buddy Mike, not the actor, by the way. He's the one who wanted to be touching equipment, but he acted in it because we got him along.
Somehow that sounds unhealthy. I want to be touching equipment.
he's the lead. There's a lot of really shitty chroma key. Because he's expected to make a chair float with his mind and make a clock and other things. So a lot of fishing line being used.
Okay.
All right. Oh, boy.
But you're high tech compared to when they were teaching us film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was black and white 16mm we were shooting.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you develop it and then you literally splice it.
Oh, yeah. I have had to do that at
okay.
least.
I got pretty good at that.
It's fun.
We did one piece... there was, I think, 3 of us involved in it, in which it was the old variation on somebody has to clear a set. Pardon me. And so he sits in a chair and points at something, and it disappears.
Yep.
So there's a lot of stop action.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't good stop action
because
basically it was like when you point, freeze.
Yeah,
and we'll
yeah.
move it, and then we'll start the camera again. But, you know, we learned.
Yeah.
You learn, it's more beneficial not to learn, not so much what you learn to do, but what you learn not to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have to cough. Mark your time.
I'm going to make a note of that. Right. We got 55:28. That'll be the time that I mark. I'll write that down. Let's say 55.
Okay. How long do you want to go on this?
I think we're in a good spot. I mean, I could interview you forever if I'd actually thought like about what the fuck to ask you.
Well, you can do part two.
Yeah, we can always do a part two. Let's see. Where do I go from here? Well, okay. So, number one, when are we going to see a re-release of your 45?
Well, you found somebody on eBay that apparently sold it.
Man, and I really wish I could have bought
it
myself.
Which is more than we could do.
I know. You had an empty sleeve until you found your mother's copy of it.
And I'm going through my late mother's boxes of a variety of keepsakes. I found an envelope that I had mailed her a copy of it. Mm-hmm. And apparently she'd opened it, looked at it, and put it back in the envelope. You know, record's never been played.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it is, you know, the phrase virgin vinyl takes on new meaning.
The art on it is really great.
I wish I could tell you who did the artwork.
I really wish I knew. It's good stuff.
It was somebody locally in Grand Rapids, Michigan, mm-hmm. who was, you know, just, we found him and he was great.
Yeah. That's good stuff. I mean, it's fun. I mean, it's not. I don't often get to meet a lot of people who are not professional comedians and who did not, or professional musicians who have released a thing on vinyl. And I think it's really cool that you put it together. I don't know. It's fun.
Okay, so
yeah.
I should go find the other vinyl that I released. Although I didn't release it, I managed the group that released it.
This I didn't know.
Rock and Roll, mm-hmm. 1965.
Okay, it's a good
time.
I'm
in high school. I'm a senior. They are juniors.
Mm-hmm.
And we recorded in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
They had been called the Paupers. They had to change their name to Ferris Wheel because there was a Canadian group called Paupers.
Okay.
Ferris
Wheel's a good name.
It was. Well, yeah.
I'm fine with it.
It was all right. We got into the studio in Cleveland, and my lead guitar player could not do this one section.
Uh-huh.
And luckily, down the hall, there was another group from our hometown
mm-hmm.
that was recording. And their lead guitarist is a guy who went on to play with Lou Reed.
Oh, wow.
Alice Cooper, a guy by the name of Dick Wagner, who's now passed. He was just a sweet man. And I went down and said, we're having trouble. Can you show Randy how to play this? And he came down, and Randy just couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick went, I'll do it. So in the midst of this 45 was an incredible guitar lick that was better than anything else on the record. And Dick got no credit and asked for no money. And,
wow.
And some years later, I connected with him on the internet, as we often do. And I thanked him, you know, again.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I said, you were such a genuine good person in that. And he said, I'm sure you got the wrong person, but I don't remember that. But okay, thanks.
I love it. Oh, my God. What was the name of the 40? What was the name of the song?
Something about breaking up.
All right.
Best part of breaking up is when you're making up. Yeah. I mean, we had some deep lyrics.
Love it. Holy shit. Do you have it somewhere?
I did. I don't know where it is. Anymore.
We're going to find that.
It's
people.
Not something that's really keepable. You know?
I know you guys are comedy fans out there, but internet help me find this. These are things I'm always... I don't know. I don't know why I'm so obsessed with like the idea of having a physical thing that proves that you made a thing. It's kind of... I don't know. I don't know what that is. It could be... I don't know.
Well, there is, as I said, you know, a friend of mine is doing did a Kickstarter for a group here in the Bay Area, and they're putting out like limited edition 180-gram vinyl
mm-hmm.
on a 12-cut LP.
Yeah,
that will be out a little later on this year.
Yeah,
and they're getting great reaction from that. And everybody wants the vinyl.
Yeah, no, and I mean the comeback is fun. Even comedy's getting, you know, a good deal of stuff. I'm actually trying to help a group right now get their thing on vinyl.
Cool.
But
let's give them a plug.
I shouldn't say because they're way more famous than I am anyway. And since it hasn't happened, the album's already out. And I've probably already talked about how much
Keep
I love the album.
Down the road,
yeah.
Jay will have revelations.
Maybe. Or it will turn out it never happened because the communication thing broke down, even though I tried really hard to make it happen.
Zeppelin did a song about that.
They certainly did.
Breakdown.
That's
yeah.
a very good point. Dick, mm-hmm. you just retired, but do you have anything to plug?
I walk dogs cheap. No, yeah. This is, I'm practicing my retired, you know, vernacular.
Uh-huh.
Get off my lawn!
It's good.
How's that?
The voice is good.
Okay.
As expected, even
Carries?
If it's not what you wanted. But yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Well, thank you guys for listening. I know this is an unusual episode because we didn't talk about a particular comedy album, but, you know, when some, you know, career retrospectives are fun and you released a fun comedy vinyl thing.
Thank you.
I want to play. I want to actually play the actual, because that's the one thing that I'm not, that I didn't get to hear, is that guy's narration thing, intro, whatever the hell you said he did.
I'll get it for you. Well, okay. he narrated the demo.
Okay. Yeah, see, that I want to hear. It's a separate thing. Anyway, thank you guys for listening, and as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.